How about this thing?
You're good. That won't record. They're not recording.
And but is it
the mic.
Oh, the mic. The mic's on.
It's on? It works?
Okay. All right. Thank you for your patience. Here we go.
Hi. Good evening. Welcome. Thank you for coming to the talk tonight. As you probably read, the main focus of my discussion tonight is going to be on the work and life of the Swedish artist Hilma af Klint. What I'm going to try to do is focus on sort of give you a little sense of her life and her biography and what happened. And I'm going to try to focus most specifically on the parts of her life and the artwork that she created that I think shows a really strong influence of her involvement in studies with the Theosophical Society at the time. So I have lots of pictures to show you. There's lots to see, so I'm going to sort of just move through it probably quickly. And then towards the end, what I want to do is kind of try to put this in context. Why am I here talking to you about this today? Why is this artist's work important now? Kind of end with a question and a little bit of a provocation to you all. So I'm going to start with, like I said, a brief history, and we'll look at some of her work. So af Klint is born in 1862 in Stockholm. She's born into a family of naval captains and mariners, a minor aristocracy. And this is Stockholm from the late 1860s. And then as a teenager, this is probably in the late 1870s, around 17 or so, she joins initially a spiritualist group in Sweden at the time. And she participates in seances and other groups, activities that are fairly typical then. This seems to be kind of be driven by the death of her sister, Hermina, during this time period. And we know historically that she was involved in these, participated in the spiritualist organizations then, but by about 20 she seems to have exited. But this sort of sets the kind of stage for what happens next with her. In the 1880s, she enrolls in the Royal Academy of Fine Arts, and she's very successful there. She graduates with honors, and she's ultimately awarded a studio to continue her work as a professional artist, which is a very prestigious thing at the time. So she begins a regular career as a working artist. She's a portraitist, a landscape painter, a commercial artist, those kinds of things. This is her in her mid-20s, in her studio in Stockholm. So just to give you a sense of the kind of work that she's making at the time, this is Summer Landscape. So this is an example of an academic work that she would have created. And to sort of give some comparison to what comes later on, I think it's helpful to understand what this kind of art is and how it's created at the time. So here's an example of another work from the same time period. This is by the British artist John William Waterhouse. This is The Lady of Shalott from 1888. This is a big work. It's like 5 foot by 7 foot. And to kind of understand how these works were made, the parallel is probably like a big budget movie today, right? So it would have involved the artist and many assistants. They would have done much preparatory work. Stick sketches, tone studies, color studies, this kind of thing, that eventually would have resulted in this painting. So it's a very big production. Simultaneously, this is another work from the same time period, 1888. This is Paul Gauguin, right? Vision After the Sermon. This is a much smaller work. Typically, Gauguin is associated with the symbolists of this era. And it's, you know, this is maybe like 2 foot by 3 foot or so. But you can see this work, it's much more immediate, right? It's not done in the same kind of developed way that the academic work was. And this is kind of the direction when we start to see Ofklint's theosophically influenced work that she'll be going in. So 1889, moving ahead. Age 27, Ofklint becomes a member of the society when it's first founded in the same year in Sweden, in the home of the Swedish writer Viktor Rydberg in Stockholm. Now, one of the things that sort of is important to understand about this connection and the strength of it is that in academic art education today, most of these connections are, we don't learn about them as artists. They're not a part of the standard art history at this point. So the fact that Ofklint has this very strong, proven relationship with a society that lasts for many decades is a very important point moving forward. The foundation that oversees her work today, in the biography of her own work, lays it out very clearly. You know, she's heavily involved in the Theosophical Society, and she was a member from the very beginning in Sweden. So this is an example of the type of work that she would have also been doing as an academically trained artist, a nature study, botanical studies, things like that. And we'll come back to this. There's one point about all of this, too, that usually when I'm giving this conversation to a public audience, there's this confusion. People often say, she has these really strong spiritual interests, but she also has these really strong scientific and empirical interests. Like, how do these things connect? I don't understand. So usually I will show the title page of The Secret Doctrine and point out, this was a part of her interest in the society. So moving ahead, we're late 1800s now. 1891, Blavatsky passes. Here's Ofklint again in her next studio. She's in her mid-30s about now. This is also an important time period, too, because we know that from a report from the Scandinavian section that this is also around the time when they complete the translation of The Secret Doctrine into Swedish. And we know she had the texts. We know that she read them. This is a very well-established point. 1890s. So it's interesting. We know that she's a member of the society. We know that she's reading and studying. But she's also, as artists tend to do, kind of doing her own thing and making a synthesis of it. So primarily, a lot of the talk about Ofklint and her biography and history right now focuses on a group of other women that she studied with who were also artists, known as the Five. I will quote regularly the work of art historian David Adams in this talk, so I'm going to read the way he describes this group at the time. In 1896, she formed with four other women the Friday Group, or the Five, a Christian spiritualist group that met weekly for the next 10 years in each other's homes and studios for meetings consisting of a prayer, meditation, reciting sermons, a study of text from the New Testament, a benediction, and ending with a seance while kneeling around an altar with a triangle and cross, from which they contacted spirits and spiritual guides. Here she is now. 1901 or so, in her late 30s. 1901, of course, is also when Thought Forms is first published. And art historically, it turns out more and more often that the publication of Thought Forms was tremendously influential to all of the abstract artists of this era. In their personal correspondence, many, many of them discuss reading the book or having seen it or in some way were influenced by it. And it's clearly probably the first sort of theory of non-representational art that begins circulating in Western Europe or America. 1903, so moving forward a little bit. She still is continuing to work as a commercial artist during this time. This is an example of her work from a Swedish publication, Christmas Gift. And so this is sort of the beginning of the work that she will then become most well known for now. Back to the Five, this is the space where they would regularly meet. And during one of their meetings, they are given a message that they will be commissioned to carry out a series of monumental paintings. They are in contact with what they're calling spirits or spirit guides at the time. And there's two of them in particular, one named Amaliel, that is basically considered by Offplint and her contemporaries more significant. And again, David Adams. The Five found themselves in regular, repeated contact with a number of named spirits. Tumahum, Amaliel, and Ananda were said to belong to a group of still more advanced spirits than the others, called Dehuga, which is the High Ones or the High Masters, whom Offclint tells us in one of her notebooks are the Master of Mysteries, synonymous with Vestal Ascetic, servants of Christ who reside in Tibet in the astral body, an exalted and holy brotherhood known to all mystics who participate in the evolution of the world. The High Masters fill the universe. So the work that she's making now in this context is very different than the academic work that she's been trained to do. This is an example of a work from 1903 that the group was making. But you can see, again, there's a strong influence of the botanical studies and nature studies and things like that. And she really begins to develop the vocabulary here that will become part of the work that she's most famous for now. So here's a great example of another thing that I oftentimes have to really strongly emphasize when I discuss this in a more public audience, the use of the spiral in her work. And again, if you can see, it's probably too small for you all to see there, but the word evolution is written many times on this page as well. So often there, what is the spiral in evolution? What is the relationship there? And of course, there's any number of quotes that we can take out of Blavatsky's writing or anyone else that I think to me shows the strong connection here. So 1906, and this is when she begins painting what will become the what are called the paintings for the temple. And in her notebooks, she records the beginning of this event this way. You know, one of the things I find most interesting about these statements is at the end she says, in the end, it became the greatest work of my life. Of course, there would be no way for her to have known this ahead of time, but yet this is exactly what happens. So she gives up at this point the work that she had been doing, the academic work, the commercial work. She begins a process of purification involving fasting and meditation and things like that. She does this for a year. And then in November of 1906, she's in her early 40s, she begins by painting this body of work. This is called Group One. And this is installed in at the Museum of Modern Art in Denmark. So here's Group One's Primordial Chaos, number four. And these, you can see, they're very different. They're much more immediate, right? She's painting very directly. Again, Adams. In the freely painted Primordial Chaos series, she explored principles of polarity, light and dark, good and evil, male and female, and their possible reunification. In these and later works, the W represents matter, while the U represents spirit, with WU indicating a union of the dualities. And in Offclint, in her own words, she describes the painting of these pieces as, the pictures were painted directly through me without any preliminary drawings and with great force. I had no idea what the paintings were supposed to depict. Nevertheless, I worked swiftly and surely without changing a single brushstroke. So it's important to understand at this point, she's basically working passively in a sense, right? She's serving as a channel. This is the sort of mode that she's operating at this time. And this will change as we go forward. 1907, so she paints. This is where she begins to paint what are her most substantial works. This is from group four, which are also known as the 10 largest. Or the ages of man. And these are all very large works. They're 10 foot by 9 foot or so. And but the thing that's really amazing about this body of works is that she takes only 4 days to make each one of these paintings. She works by herself. She has a single assistant. Here they are installed at the Guggenheim. And there's the catalog from the exhibition over there. And these are really big, substantial works. If you ever see these in person, they're really interesting. They're paper, they're painted with tempera, but they are then mounted to canvas. So they have this real physical kind of texture to them, almost like a leather skin. So one of the other things that art historians and conservators have noted about this series is that they have footprints on them. And that's because they're all painted on the floor. So she cleared the space of her studio, and she laid out the largest piece of paper she could find, and she painted them just like that very immediately, very fast. There's a really interesting documentary that's just now come out called Beyond the Visible. And as part of that documentary, they actually staged the painting of these works. Here's a still from that movie. So to give you some context of what else is going on at this moment when she's doing this work, early 1906, 1907. 1907 is the same year that Picasso paints La Demoiselle d'Avignon. And this work, which is considered the preliminary work of Cubism, it's a large work, is not nearly the scale of Ofclint's work. Simultaneously, the gentleman who's typically given credit for the introduction of abstract art into the West, Kandinsky, this is what he's painting at this time period. He's painting landscapes, he's painting representational work. He hasn't yet begun to paint these works, or the works that he's made that have been influenced by his theosophical studies. And another one, this is Mondrian from 1908. So to continue with this story, I have to delve into some history here. I know that sometimes this can be sensitive topics, so I'm going to try to just present this in terms of figures and names and times and to try to move forward as factually as possible. So a lot of you probably recognize the individuals in this image. 1902, Rudolf Steiner has become head of the newly formed German section of the Theosophical Society. And over the years following up to 1908, which is where it intersects with our story, he takes on a number of increasingly important roles in the society's activities in Western and Central Europe. This is Steiner and Besant from 1907. So in 1908, after a number of letter-writing processes, Ofclint, who is a member of the society, has been reaching out regular to the head of the German section, Steiner, and finally arranges a studio visit with him. He gets him to come to her studio. This is really significant because all of the other artists of this era, Kandinsky, Mondrian, they've tried to do this same thing, and none of them have been able to succeed. And this studio visit has now become legendary and controversial for a number of reasons. Because what happens after the studio visit is she stops making work for about 4 years. This is another example of work that she makes at the beginning of 1908. And they're constant. The double spiral motif becomes constant for the rest of her life. So Eka Font, who is a Swedish art historian, she's one of the earliest people to really start writing about Ofclint's work. This is how she describes this studio visit. By chance, Rudolf Steiner, Secretary General of the Theosophical Association German section, visited Hilma Ofclint. Most likely the visit occurred in 1908, He witnessed the entire body of work, which had been inspired by his lead, and he expressed himself on the paintings. There are only vague notes from this visit, and the exact time is not completely established, but one of the things that Steiner said to her is that that he had no possibility, didn't understand the work either, and that he thought that perhaps in another 50 years the work would become understandable by the general public. This becomes very significant over on Earth. And the other thing he really says, and this is a point that, again, I feel you all will probably understand much clearer, he also really objected to her working atavistically and passively. Because remember, at this point, she's primarily operating as a channel. She's, you know, making this contact with what she's calling spirit guides, and she's basically painting directly from that motivation. And he really encouraged her to instead develop her own spiritual faculties and to take a more inwardly active and independent role in the artistic creation. And that he felt was a more proper way to obtain and express spiritual knowledge through art. So this studio visit has become very controversial because in a certain sense people don't understand this particular point of it. And there's an American curator, I think one of the ones who helped put together the Guggenheim show, who called it a studio visit from hell. And they sort of point to the fact that she stopped making work after it as like, oh, this terrible man can stop this woman from doing work. But I imagine I understand what he's saying and I agree with it in many ways. And so here she is, 1910. She's about 48. The next year, Kandinsky publishes On the Spiritual and Art. And if you've ever read the text, you will be aware that he regularly and liberally discusses Theosophy. He quotes Blavatsky in this text. Mondrian again. 1910, he's moved to Paris. When he moves to Paris, he actually first arrives and stays with the Theosophical Society in Paris. They give him a place to stay when he first arrives. This is a work of his from that era. And I think the symbolism is probably clear. 1910, 1913, this is Kandinsky's first abstract work. It's funny, it's dated 1910, but the art historians think it's actually from 1913. So there's an interesting question here. If he's post-dating his work, perhaps. 1913. Let me go back one, sorry. Auf-Klint participates in the Congress of the Theosophical Society in Stockholm. So we know she was still actively a member at this point. And during this time, she paints what has become, at this point, her probably most well-known works. This is group 10, number one. This is called the altarpiece. This is, to her, the summation of this series of works. There's three of them. This is installed at the Guggenheim. Now, one of the things you have to be very conscious of when you're looking at her artwork as it's typically installed in museums, this is not in order. This is number one. This is number two. That's number three. And this happens a lot. They'll switch the order around. But she had definite reason to want to make these in certain orders. And this is how she described this series. These three images are the summary of the whole work. So I imagine many of you will look at this and make strong connections already about what this she's attempting to represent in this body of work. And you can pick any number of quotations or passages from The Secret Doctrine to describe this work. So, number two. I had a really nice conversation with Pablo over the summer about the possible symbolism behind these works. I'm going to paraphrase and quote a little bit some of our conversation about this. In one of the things that he was sort of mentioned, you know, perhaps painting two, she's trying to represent the downward manifestation of the universal self in the circle. into the individual self was the point, or the descent of spirit into matter. The spiral can perhaps represent the cyclical evolution of this, and the central pillar could either be the bridge of communication between these two selves, or the cosmic life wave coming from the third logos. And then number three from this too, right? Perhaps what we're seeing here is related to Blavatsky's use of the symbols for the logoi, right? So in this one, perhaps the first logos is the not yet manifested cause, which gives rise then to an intermediate state in the second logos, which then produces the manifested or third logos, whose symbol is a cross within the circle. It is from the third logos that the seven rays come. If you look at the painting, you can see the central dot. The cross is implied in the four different colors in the background. And then the seven rays coming from the lower part of the circle. Right. So I'm a great fan of these pieces. And I think I had a great breakthrough when I was looking at this work, and then at one point reading, I think, very early on in the first volume of The Secret Doctrine, and this is the Swan series. The Swan, why the Swan? So this is that same body of work, same series, and you can see it goes through an incredible range of variation, from representational to much more abstract. Here's the 10th in the series, so the churning between these opposites. And ends like this, the cube, the different rays. So the swan, right? The Hansa. Here's Brahma with his Hansa Vahan, the vehicle. Sarasvati, his complement, also has the Hansa. So I'm fairly confident that what Off-Clint was looking at when she was thinking about these paintings was the Kalahansa, right? Hence, Brahm was called Kalahansa, the swan in time and space. He became the swan of eternity who lays at the beginning of each Maha Mahanvantra a golden egg. Kalahansa has a dual meaning. Exoterically, it is Brahma who is the swan, the great bird, the vehicle in which darkness manifests itself to human comprehension as light in this universe. But esoterically, it is darkness itself, the unknowable absolute, which is the source. And I think that, so we should understand that this series, she's trying to, as an artist, work out her understanding of this cosmological system. And I think that there's a really strong case for this because what follows the swan is the dove. And this is the first from the dove. And this series equally covers a tremendous amount of ground. This is the sixth in that series. And the 14th. So she seems to be working from unmanifest to manifest to increasingly specific kinds of manifestation. Okay, so we're around the 19-teens now. And back to this. So 1913, some of you might be aware, this is during the time period when the tensions between the central Western sort of theosophical groups who are aligned with Steiner, there's a secession. And the theosophists that are following Steiner, they split many thousands, and they secede. This is actually played out really interestingly in the general reports. If you look at this, is from the 1914 general report of the 38th anniversary and convention of the Theosophical Society. And it has this very interesting message in there. The lodges, the charters of the German lodges have all lapsed. And indeed, if you look further, you can see that the charter dates of all the lodges are from 12 or 13 of that year. 1914, when World War I begins. So this is kind of the moment where Ofclint, her work and her influence of the participation in the society kind of come to the end. By 1916, she ultimately leaves the society with the Steiner secession. But I think it's very helpful to understand what happens because her work takes an immediate change at this moment. And to me, it points to the influence of her theosophical studies as a result. So what she starts doing after this point is she does these sort of botanical studies. She does these esoteric studies of nature. She begins to develop a system for looking at nature and using an abstract symbolism to communicate the sort of inner qualities of the things that she's studying. This is from that series. This is 1919. And she basically begins to create these notebooks where she does this process. And this is her major output during this time period. She does reach back to some of the earlier work that she's been doing. This series, I think, is particularly interesting for this. This is called Series 2. Number one, this is the starting picture from 1920. These are all small, right? So she was working enormously, and now everything she does is small. This is the starting picture. And so what she's basically doing is she's trying to come up with a way of abstractly representing the position of different spiritual traditions in her time. So this is number three, the Buddha's standpoint in the earthly life. And later on, number 20, the current standpoint of the Mahatmas. Okay, so we'll kind of jump through to the end now. Just to show you now, this is Mondrian, 1921. This is where he sort of develops his mature style that he becomes most well-known for. This is the work that Ofclint is making now at this time period on viewing the flowers and trees. It's a small watercolor, 7 by 10 or so. And this is Kandinsky from 1923, so now he's also kind of reached his mature stage or his mature style. Position 8. 1925, Steiner passes away. 33, Besant passes. 39, World War II. This is about one of the last known works by him, Ofclint. This is from 1941. It's a small watercolor on paper. But to the very end, she's very committed to this use of the spiral in her work, the double spiral as well. 1944, this is the end of a timeline. In February of that year, Mondrian passes away, now living in New York. In October 9th, 1944, Ofclint writes what will be the last entry in her journal. You have a mystery service ahead and will soon enough realize what is expected of you. On October 21st, 1944, she passes following a traffic accident at nearly 82. She leaves behind approximately 1,300 paintings and 125 note and sketchbooks of approximately 26,000 pages, which, according to her will, shall not be shown until at least 20 years after her death, and none should ever be sold. So if you do the math and you go back to that 1908 studio visit, you will realize that that makes 50 years exactly. 1944, December, Kandinsky passes away. 1945, during post-World War II. So what happens is she wills her entire body of work to her relatives. They're not sure exactly what to do with it. They have the ability to at least take care of it. And it's ultimately stored at an anthroposophical colony in Järna, Sweden. This is that site today. And that's where it stays for almost 50 years. Okay, so I want to just kind of, that's the history, that's what happened before. And I strongly encourage you, there's many really great texts and books that have come out now on her work, and go deeply into many of these things. It's unusual to find art historians and curators who have a familiarity with theosophical doctrine, so you will, you know, find a very confused kind of theorization about what she's doing. But I feel like if you've ever looked at the primary sources and you've ever read theosophical texts, you will immediately pick up on what she's been trying to do. So I want to just end or kind of go into this last part to just sort of say, like, why is this important now? Like, why? Yes, it's great. This is remarkable. This is a very interesting artist whose work was largely unknown until very recently. But I think that this points to something much larger that's happening. And I'm I work in the art world. I'm a practicing artist. And I really, over the last decade, have seen something that has been developing. And that's what I would really like to share and perhaps get your feedback or your impressions on as well. So the first place that Ofklint's work is shown internationally and publicly is actually here in Los Angeles in 1985 at this exhibition, The Spiritual and Art, Abstract Painting, 1890-1985. And there's a really amazing history of how this work gets from that colony in Järna in Sweden to Los Angeles. Here it is installed at LACMA with Duchamp. So back over in Sweden, you know, they've been kind of regularly showing her work every now and then. But in 2013, they mount this exhibition, Hilma af Klint, A Pioneer of Abstraction. And it becomes their most attended exhibition ever. And not only is it their most attended exhibition ever, but it gets more international press than anything that they've done up to this point. And this is how they describe it in their own writing. So back across the Atlantic, at the Utah State University, they mount this exhibition called Enchanted Modernities, Mysticism, Landscape, and the American West. And one of the things they set out to do in this exhibition is they say, this is the first exhibition to address the formation of theosophy, its eventual presence in the Western United States, and its marginalized and yet widespread influence on visual art and music of the 20th century. This work features heavily the paintings of Agnes Pelton. So this is an example of her work. And she was a member of the Transcendentalist Painters Group, and their theosophical influences have been well documented already. We know that actually Pelton traveled. She lived in Cathedral City, not far from Palm Springs, and she would travel into Los Angeles to attend study groups. This is Pelton describing her abstractions. They are not material, but mental images. So again, the thought forms resonance. Back across the Atlantic again, 2015, the 14th annual Istanbul Biennial, is called Saltwater, A Theory of Thought Forms. And at this exhibition, they display apparently the original paintings that were used for lithographs and thought forms. And there was a whole process. I know some of the people who were involved in this to actually discover those. Apparently, they were in storage at Adyar, and they found them and put them in display in this exhibition. At the same time, the Courtauld Institute of Art in 2016 mounts this exhibition on a basically an unknown British artist, Georgiana Houghton, called Spirit Drawings. And this is a cropped image of one of her works here. You might have some resonance if what you've seen from Ofklint earlier. And Houghton is a spiritualist, and she's been making these drawings and paintings 1850, 1816 or so. Not in any way accounted for in our history at this point. This exhibition is really significant because it produces this kind of press. And this article is actually in the Times and was written by a British art critic, Valdemar Jan Skozak. And he basically is like, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I made a mistake when I was criticizing this before. Clearly, the fact that the spiritual and metaphysical in this interests of these artists was key to the development of modern art. Back more locally, the Getty Research Institute stages an exhibition on the art of alchemy. That's very well received here. 2017, there's a number of texts that start coming out. So this is Aaron Rosen's Art and Religion in the 21st Century. I think one of the things I need to kind of emphasize that I sort of said in the beginning is that one of the things about the production and education of contemporary artists is that religion and spirituality has been totally wiped out of that conversation. I mean, it's just not something that we in any way discuss or research. It's something that is in the past and it's gone. So the fact that now we're starting to see these texts and these critical sort of surveys that are discussing these things is very unusual. The Irish Museum of Modern Art stages As Above, So Below, Portals, Visions, Spirits, and Mystics. And they have off Clint's work there. Later that same year, the Guggenheim stages Mystical Symbolism, and this is an exhibition about the Rosen Cross Salon in Paris in the 1890s. And it strongly features the work of Jean Davy. And Davy, name you may or may not know, he was actually a very involved member of the society. And he eventually, in the early 1910s, he founded the Belgian section. And he served as their first general secretary from 1911 to 1913. He gave a really nice talk at the first annual congress of the Federation of the European Sections of the Theosophical Society on the mission of art. Back across the Atlantic again, art museums are staging these kinds of spiritual or meditation or sound baths or things like this. These are starting to happen more and more. This very nice text came out last year, Encountering the Spiritual in Contemporary Art. And the way they describe this is, encountering the spiritual provides an alternative to the main currents of presentation and interpretation prevalent in contemporary art, appealing to believers, agnostics, and inveterate skeptics alike. This essential publication demonstrates that the need to address the fundamental questions of life are both innate and ongoing. Late 2018, Guggenheim stages Hilmoth Klint Paintings for the Future. This is the first solo retrospective of her work in America, and it fills the entire museum. It also becomes their most well-attended exhibition ever. A little bit closer, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Tucson stages Blessed Be, Mysticism, Spirituality, and the Occult in Contemporary Art. So you remember that exhibition that we kind of started earlier on that was at Utah State? They finally publish the catalog for that exhibition, and they've changed the title. Now it's called China Modernity's Theosophy, the Arts in the American West. This just came out in September. It's really good. And this leads to all kinds of press articles about this subject. A new book charts theosophy's influence on Western modernism. They're back in the East Coast, the Andy Warhol Museum of Art stages Andy Warhol Revelation, which is an investigation on the importance of spirituality and religion on the work of Andy Warhol, who's typically considered a pop artist who has no connection with any of this at all. The venerable photography magazine Aperture, their winter issue, was on spirituality. Back over to Europe again. This is the National Museum of 21st Century Art in Rome, and they're in the process of staging On the Spiritual Matter of Art. I just returned from San Diego at the San Diego History Center, where they have a very nice exhibition on Art of Theosophy at Romoland. And it has probably the best presentation of all of that artwork and material that I've seen to date. The Whitney in New York announces a major retrospective of the work of Agnes Pelton, the Theosophical student we looked at earlier on. I'm told that this is going to come to the Palm Springs Museum, so we'll have a chance probably to see it. Just yesterday, when I returned from the San Diego trip, ArtNet News, who is a major sort of collector and publicator of news in the art world, published this article. Spirituality has long been erased from art history, and here's why it's having a resurgence today. So, I would like to end this with a bit of a provocation. In the process of doing this research, I was able to look at an incredible range of very interesting things. And one of the things I came across is this photograph. This is a photograph of the Congress of the European Federation of the Sections of the Theosophical Society in 1907. This is usually called the Munich Congress. It's Andy Besson. Steiner. But the thing I really want you to look at is what's in the room behind them. So you can see that there are these round paintings around the room. There's painted columns and there's sculpture. Now, apparently when this was done for the Congress, this was very controversial. And it, maybe the controversy was stemming from something else, but the focus was on the fact that there was art in this room. And this was apparently a big point of disagreement, that there should not be visual art in the room where the Congress was taking place. I had the chance to read some sections from Steiner's autobiography that he wrote about 20 years later. And this is what he has to say about that moment and his experiences there. In the Theosophical Society, artistic interests were scarcely fostered at all. From a certain point of view, this situation was at that time quite intelligible, but it ought not to have continued if there was a true sense the spiritual was to be nurtured. The members of such a society center all their interests at first upon the reality of the spiritual life. In the sense world, man appears to them only in his transitory existence, severed from the spiritual. Art seems to them to have its activity within this severed existence. It seems, therefore, to be apart from the spiritual reality for which they seek. Because this is so in the Theosophical Society, artists did not feel at home there. So my question is, thinking about this statement and knowing the history, because what we saw with Off Klint is she is invested for almost 30 years, more than 30 years, she is a member. And at some point, there is a disconnect. And this story repeats for many of the artists of this era. They become very involved and invested, and something causes them to leave. So my question is this an accurate criticism? Is what he wrote about the society at the time, and perhaps now, accurate about its relationship with the arts? Is it an accurate criticism, but he's missing the point? Like, yes, the art is of the physical, of the material, is not of the spiritual. And perhaps most importantly, what we've talked about is history, but today and in the future, what is the place for the arts in the society moving forward? Anyways, this is my Instagram and my website. Thank you very much.
Forty-five slides. I was like, "Oh, you're not getting there." They said, "No, it's 45 minutes and a time, 45 minutes and 44 seconds." So that's impressive in itself. So thank you. That was wonderful to hear. I know very little about art, so it's nice to see the art and then learn the background with it. But thank you all for coming. Questions. Sorry.
Yeah.
Questions. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
This is just an addition.
Yeah.
I wrote a book in 2014 on the spiritual dynamic in modern art.
Yeah.
How Gray McMillan published. It was reviewed with Aaron Rosen's book in Art in America, and I think it's in that ArtNet article.
Wonderful.
But I happen to come across, there's a lot about Himmler Clintus, the first of the six founders of abstract art.
Yeah.
And in my research, I happen to come upon another witness from that studio visit.
Good.
Who sort of supports that essay that you were talking about, the studio visit from hell. And it was in a book on artisan depression, actually. And the account there said, when Steiner saw her studio, he was very disconcerted. Mm-hmm. And he was angry about two things. And I'm really glad you brought that picture with the male and the female on either side of the evolutionary spiral,
yes.
Because he got very angry about that. I've never seen that. He got very angry about that painting because she has them in an equal place, the male and female in an equal place on the evolutionary spiral.
Huh.
And he said that's not correct.
Huh.
The female is not on the equal place with the male. And the other thing that made him angry was just, he looked around the room and thought, holy Toledo, she's a seer. She's
yes.
putting out original teachings like I am.
Huh.
And he, you know, I think that was a cover saying, oh, you shouldn't be a medium, you should be an adept. But people watching saw him very angry, and I think that makes sense because she shut down for 4 years. She was so shaken by that visit. She
right.
stopped working for 4 years. So it wasn't just a little, oh, you know, you ought to do this or that, at least according to the witnesses that were quoted in that book on depression. So I'm so glad you brought that painting because I've wondered about it. And I think the other thing, your last question you asked us, you know, his critique of, well, in the Theosophical, the art wasn't...
the artist didn't feel welcome, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, Kandinsky and all the other six were all influenced by Theosophy.
Yeah.
Before Steiner made his break, I mean, once he wasn't selected to be the world teacher, once Besson selects, you know, Krishnamurti,
yeah.
he breaks away
yes.
and makes his own club.
Yes.
And of course, a lot of artists did go to hear him in Berlin, and but they didn't really see it as a break. They were still situated, like Kandinsky, in Theosophy, but they were also interested in what he was going to say. For them, it wasn't an either or.
Yeah.
But I think that's what that quote, you know, the undercurrent of the quote, well, you wouldn't really get a lot of artistic influence in Theosophy, but you did.
Yeah.
You know, and so anyway, I just thought this was so rich and interesting, and thank you for coming to OPI.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Can I just respond just a second there? I've never seen an in-depth, like, original source other than the occasional ones about that studio visit. So it's interesting to hear that you found. I wonder what the source is.
Well, it's in my files.
Okay.
I've got a flyer to give you.
And thank you.
I'll put my email address on it. We can exchange emails.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. No, regarding your question, I think it's interesting. I never thought about that, whether how art was, you know, received in the society. I don't know about the 20s and early 30s, but from the later 30s to the 50s, General Jarasa, he was an artist.
Yeah.
He wrote about art and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
So he did promote the artistic view. It's not that common, it's true. You don't see many theosophies, you know, talking about art. But during his time, certainly art was highly regarded. But I don't know before. That's an interesting area of study.
Yeah, I've read many of his writings on art, and
yeah.
I think they're very helpful.
Yeah.
I don't know why it has to be criticized or thought lesser that she... I mean, she said she was making her work as a direct line from her spiritual
yeah.
inspiration.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? I mean, it's not the typical sort of you know, art historical way that modern art has been written to have evolved and
sure.
come to be. But, you know, I don't...
I think
she's still, in terms
yeah.
of today, I mean, I did see the show at the Guggenheim.
Yeah.
And I think today that there's still a big question about whether she was actually painting paintings or whether she was painting diagrams.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that they can't bring themselves to say that these were amazing abstractions
right.
at a time earlier than the guys.
Yeah.
And...
The diagram question is really interesting. Yeah.
Pardon?
The diagram argument is
yeah.
a really interesting one. And, like, that, yeah, I mean, the fact that there is, like, such a struggle with needing to just say this is art and it's painting, and needing to sort of say, like, no, it's a spiritual diagram of something as a way to avoid needing to bring her in. I mean, I think the biggest issue is that the overtness of her spiritual and metaphysical influences is so undeniable, because what really has happened was, you know, from 1930 to really this moment, there has been such an aggression, like an aggressive attempt to erase all of that. You know, it's like, oh, Kandinsky, yeah, he was into this stuff, but it's not part of his mature style, right? It's just something he was dabbling in when he was younger. And so there's a whole line of art criticism and art history writing that's the focus. That, yeah, they were into these things, but it's not important for their later work. But in the case of Auchinleck, you can't make that statement at all. It's so clearly important to everything that she did and all of the work that we're now celebrating and filling with museums, that you can't make that argument.
Yeah, I think that the work can be appreciated without being a theosophist or,
mm-hmm.
or spiritual in
yeah.
in especially the what is it, the ten or
yeah,
the
ten largest
the temple.
Yeah.
Those are just overwhelmingly amazing,
yeah.
beautiful, less diagrammatic, I believe.
Yeah.
And from my point of view.
Yeah. Yeah, if anything, the diagrammatic is a kind of, to me, is if anything a clearly more theosophical influence, right? Like it's in a sense like if you pick up the Secret Doctrine, what do you find in it? It's diagrams.
Well, also, you're bringing up the spiritual into art, or that it's a new twist, relatively new. I mean, you know, in the Renaissance, and I mean, art has been associated with religion forever.
Yeah.
And various ways and various sources, and you know, at some point you could only make, if you wanted to make money as an artist, you could only make work about religion.
Yeah.
Which I'm calling it religion versus spiritualism, but maybe it's not that different.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. The study of art history is the study of spiritual art, right? I mean, that's really when you pick up an art history book and you go through all the hundreds of years of art history, what you're studying is the history of spiritual art.
But the difference now is abstraction, that element of.
There's definitely a part, you know, when I do this sort of more expanded version of this lecture, like what I like to bring up is tantric painting, right? Which is something that I think has largely not been acknowledged as a clear influence on not only the theosophical understanding of abstract imagery, but of Klimt's. You know, that there's a really great article that I like just pulled from The Hindu, which is a, you know, weekly or daily newspaper that's in Chennai, right, where they basically say, Thelma Auchinleck, tantric artist. Mm-hmm. You know, so from that cultural perspective, it's very clear what it is she's doing. But we're, and I guess, you know, in Western Europe and America, still struggling with the idea that somehow this could be a multicultural thing and this might exist. The lineage of non-representational art comes from outside of our culture entirely and is being cultivated just now or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's mainly more something I'm working out in my mind about your question at the end, this
yeah.
provocation about what place does art have
yeah.
in the Theosophical Society. And not being a member myself or knowing much about it,
mm-hmm.
what gets stirred up for me is imagining in a spiritual practice or even listening to the objects in the beginning. It seems like if you're an artist, it's going to stir you up in a particular way that's going to manifest through your art. So I don't even know how it could be a question that there wouldn't be a place for it.
Yeah. Yeah, but at the same, it's like coming out of a contemporary art world as an academically trained artist. That's the condition that we exist in.
Yeah.
That there is no connection.
Yeah.
And you know, that's that's been defended for 50 or 75 years now. So yeah, I totally agree.
Alan, did you have a question?
No.
Oh.
You used the phrase non-representational a few moments ago, and I think it's worth remembering that all of these artists in the early 20th century who were influenced by theosophy and have declared that worked non-representationally or non-objectively is
mm-hmm.
another term for it. So
yeah.
The effect is somewhat subliminal, you might say, rather than overt. You know, they don't have to make pictures of angels, etc., in order to make spiritual art.
Yeah. Totally.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I do need to thank Annie. She's always here for me to make sure that the PowerPoints get on the screen, so thank you. We have a public lecture every first Tuesday of the month. The next public lecture is Ken Small, who will be here to talk about, he was a theosophist from Loma Land, which was down in San Diego with Catherine Tingley. We have